Okay, dear friends in Dharma, we are going to start the Sutta teaching session. So first of all, we pay homage to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. So we were discussing Nagarupama Sutta, the simile of the fortress. So basically in this Buddha actually give a account of various parts in a particular fortress, so that it will affirm or confirm the security of the kingdom, security of the fortress. And likewise he mentioned about seven types of what it calls as appurtenances, or we can call them as the protective devices or protective measures that a particular country, particular kingdom has taken. So Buddha outlined seven of those protective actions, and then he goes on to mention about four types of nutriments. So we were discussing the seven. Actually the number one Buddha mentioned is the pillar, which is a very deep, very strong, securely planted, and it is in the at the center of the kingdom. So that is being used maybe for some kind of a protective mechanism during that old days. So that is strongly mentioned, strongly dug deep and properly planted. That is one thing. The second one is the moat, which is also dug deep and it is also very wide. So if someone has to come to the kingdom, so they have to cross, they have to swim, or they have to cross the moat, and that is the second item that Buddha mentioned. So probably there may be some dangerous animals like crocodiles, etc., might have been there, so that it's very difficult to cross simply by swimming. And if someone is coming through other various mechanisms, so others can easily notice them. Therefore, this moat, which is dug deep and wide, is also another protective measure taken in this traditional kingdom. And then the third one is the patrol path, so which is high and again wide. And therefore, one can, the soldiers or whoever in patrol, so they can go around the kingdom, they can go around the fortress, and they can see what are the any threats or any kind of things are there for their sort of enemies are coming or something like that, they can watch. So that is also available, that is called the patrol path. And the fourth one is called the weapons. So various kinds of weapons are there. So Buddha has given an account of various weapons available in the fortress, so that is also given. So actually, so weapons are needed to attack the enemies, so that is also available. And then number five, there are troops, various different kinds of troops are there. So there may be elephant troops, there may be cavalry, charioteers, archers, standard bearers, camp marshals. So likewise, so those days also they have various different kinds of troops, and they are also there. And again, number six is the gatekeeper. So he's a vigilant person, diligent person, and again he's with a very good memory, and he knows to whom to be allowed, and they know whom to be not allowed. And so that is also there, and that is actually another part of the protective measure taken in order to protect the kingdom. The gatekeeper, through him everyone has to go in, through him everyone has to go out. So he basically checks, investigates who are the proper people, who are not the proper people. Then number seven, that is the wall, very strong wall, and it's called rampart, is high and wide, and that is also built around the kingdom, around the fortress. So there is no hole there, it is very well plastered, And therefore, there is no any kind of a cavity or hole or something that someone can go through. So that is also available. So likewise, these seven measures were taken in order to protect the city, in order to protect the fortress. Now, Buddha sort of explained these things. Now, with respect to certain mental qualities, spiritual qualities, one needs to have. And so now we'll go through them, and actually these already discussed. I am just rushing through. The first one is the that securely planted, immobile, unshakable kind of that pillar. So Buddha makes it similar to the faith. The faith a person, a practitioner has towards the Buddha, towards Dhamma, towards Sangha. So basically the unshakable faith. So one has to have unshakable faith. So Buddha makes it similar to this kind of unshakable pillar. So it is not wavering, it's not moving. It's properly planted, it's deeply rooted. So such kind of faith is required, and Buddha mentioned it is a important protective measure one has to have in the spiritual path. That is one thing. Then the second one is the moat. That is the kind of wide and deep, the river type of thing, kind of a canal, where if someone has to come through, then they have to cross that moat. So it's a kind of a protective measure. If some kind of a enemy coming, then he has to go through that. It's quite difficult. Therefore, the enemies are reluctant to come through because others may notice. So similarly, Buddha mentioned it is similar to moral shame. So if a defilement comes and if one were to transgress, so this particular moat, this particular moral shame has to be crossed through. It's very difficult. If one has very strong moral shame, it is very unlikely that he would go for a transgression, breaching of the precept, because he has very firm moral shame. So therefore, moral shame, Buddha mentioned, is similar to this king's frontier fortress, has this moat which is deeply dug and wide. So that is a very interesting protective measure taken in the kingdom. Similarly, in a spiritual practitioner has to have this kind of a moral shame. So moral shame, if one has, then it is unlikely that he may do any kind of a transgression. Then number three is the petrol path. So that is also a moral kind of a measure available in the kingdom. So people, the soldiers, are always in petrol, and they investigate, they supervise, do a kind of a surveillance to see whether there are any enemies coming. So similarly, if one has moral dread or moral fear, then Buddha mentioned it's very unlikely he would do any kind of a transgression. There may be defilements coming, but he stops at that level without implementing them, without being a slave to those defilements, because he has moral dread or moral fear, because he is afraid of doing any kind of wrong, afraid of doing any kind of breach. So he is very well protected as a result of these two qualities, moral shame and moral dread. And that is very important, because sometimes when defilements are arising in the mind, if one is not careful, if one is not shameful, if one is not fearful about those things, then say they simply allow them to come, they even support them, and ultimately go for a transgression. So moral shame and moral dread is two other protective measures one has to have. Then number four is the weapons. So various different kinds of weapons are there. So those may be very, very dangerous kind of weapons. And so whenever an enemy comes, so the soldiers can use them and attack them and chase them away. Similarly, Buddha mentioned one has to be well learned. So Buddha's teaching, which is sublime in the beginning, sublime in the middle, and sublime in the end, so that those Dhamma has to be learned. So if one has a very good knowledge about these dhammas, so that is kind of a weapon that one has. Because if someone else may come and give a wrong idea, give a wrong kind of a concept, then immediately one can apply one's own knowledge, one also very well learned. So as a result of that, one can verify with one's own knowledge, gathered knowledge of the Buddha's teaching, in order to verify someone else's same kind of misidea, and can remove that. So one is again protected from going astray. And then number five is the soldiers. And various soldiers are there, or various troops are there, and that they are also kind of charged, they are also very well equipped, they are also always ready to attack. So that is one protective measure taken in the kingdom. Similarly, Buddha mentioned one has to have energy, always energetic. So it is not sort of satisfied with some minor things. Rather, one is always have a great objective, has a great goal, and he is always keeping that in mind, not neglecting them, and maintain a very good energetic kind of enthusiasm towards the goal. So there may be various obstacles in the path, there may be various difficulties, and one may go through them because one has very good energy, very good effort. So that is what the mention is similar to various kinds of troops who are protecting the kingdom from various enemies. Then number six, which is also very interesting in the as practitioners, the gatekeeper. Gatekeeper is a wise gatekeeper, and he remembers who are the proper people, who are the residents, and who are not the proper people, who are the thieves. So that is similar to mindfulness. So when one has mindfulness, so one is fully awake, one is diligent, and one knows what exactly are to be done, what exactly not to be done, and what are the good things, what are the bad things. So likewise, one has this proper monitoring process going on when mindfulness is available. So mindfulness is therefore again a protective measure using which one abandons what is bad and one continues or develops what is good. That is number six. Then number seven, that is the wide and strong wall which is well plastered. There is no any hole or any passage which through one can come through, but it is very protected, very strong, high standing wall. Similarly, Buddha mentioned one has wisdom. In the spiritual side, it is the wisdom. So this wisdom is not mere book knowledge. Book knowledge is already discussed. Now here it is the penetrative meditative knowledge. One has practiced. One has certain developed qualities, and using which one has developed a fair amount of vipassana knowledges, insight knowledges, and that is what counted here. So one is well equipped, but equipped with wisdom. Now these are the seven qualities that Buddha mentioned here. And then he goes on to explain the other four qualities, or what we can say as the four nutriments. And what are the four jhanas that constitute the higher mind and are pleasant dwellings in this very life, which he gains at will without trouble or difficulty. Now Buddha goes on explaining the jhana. Now, just as bhikkhus, much grass, firewood and water are stored up in the king's frontier fortress for the delight, relief and comfort of its inhabitants and for warding off outsiders, so too, secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, a noble disciple enters and dwells in the first jhana, which consists of rapture and pleasure born of seclusion, accompanied by thought and examination. for his own delight, relief and comfort, and for entering upon Nibbana. Now one important thing here is that this first jhana is a mechanism to abandon defilements temporarily, and particularly the hindrances. We know that there are 5 hindrances, and when one attains the first jhana, so those 5 hindrances are abandoned. Those 5 hindrances are subsided. Now, how one can do that? So basically, if one is developing fair amount of, vitakka, what we call as, so one is taking any kind of a primary object, suppose it is the breath, again and again one is applying one's mind to breath, in breath, out breath, in breath, out breath, so likewise continuously applying one's mind. So if that is happening, then mind can't be lethargic, because again and again the next in-breath or next out-breath is approaching. So one has to be keep vigilant so that one is able to be aware of the next in-breath or next out-breath. So this diligence, this vigilance is completely against the lethargic or kind of sloth and torpor, the laziness, drowsiness available in the mind. So if this vitakka, this applied thought is well developed, one is quickly capable of applying one's mind to the incoming phenomena. So that indicates one is capable of overcoming sloth and torpor, thinamidda. And again, not only that, if one is sort of established on that particular phenomena. Now, suppose it is the breath. Now, one is observing the breath and investigating the breath. So this investigation helps to abandon any kind of a doubt, because investigation basically removes any kind of doubt, so he knows exactly, okay, this is the in-breath, this is the out-breath, he is not mistaken, he is quite sure, now this is the in-breath I am experiencing, this is the out-breath I am experiencing. Or sometimes even if one go further, one can say, so this is the beginning of the in-breath I am experiencing, not the middle, not the end. Now it is the middle of the in-breath I am experiencing, not the beginning, not the end. Now this is the end of the in-breath I am experiencing, not the beginning, not the middle. So likewise, one is quite assured, quite confident what one is continuing, what one is doing. Currently, I am investigating this particular portion of the primary object. So likewise, so this kind of a confidence, this kind of an assurance, this kind of an investigation is quite contrary to doubt or any kind of a perplexity in the mind. So there is no perplexity in the mind because he is quite sure, okay, this is the in-breath, and even there I am now experiencing the middle part of the in-breath. So likewise, he is quite sure about it. So this quality, what we call as the sustained attention or the kind of an investigation, is quite opposite to doubt or vichikicca. So the vichikicca is abandoned as a result of this investigation. And then, as a result of proper applied thought, proper investigation, now slowly one becomes quite confident in one's practice. Again and again one can continue one's practice. Now what happens? He gets some kind of a happiness, kind of a joy, because now the situation is quite favorable, things are happening smoothly, one understands the path, one is confident about one's practice, so the kind of a little happiness, little kind of a ease is now developing in the mind. Previously there was kind of a struggle, but now no more, now things are happening smoothly. Now this little happiness, this little feeling ease is now developed, and when it is available, so when happiness is available, there is no possibility of arising ill will in the mind. Ill will is abandoned when happiness is available. Vyapada is abandoned when happiness is available. So happiness, joy, or we can call it as rapture, is the kind of the developed quality. When it is available, there is no ill will. So rapture, piti, is therefore against working against the ill will which can happen in the mind. And again, when all these things are happening, so the body also starts giving some support. Previously there were maybe aches and pains, but no more aches and pains. Now body also supporting, body becomes tranquil, mind also becomes tranquil, and everything is happening smoothly. As a result of that, now one feels kind of comfortable. There is no discomfort now, but now quite things are somewhat happy, somewhat pleasurable, or somewhat fairly comfortable. So as a result of that, mind doesn't want to regret, mind doesn't want to go towards past, go towards the future, because the present moment, present dwelling, present place is quite comfortable. So if we consider why our minds are sort of drifting, why our minds are wandering, it's very much like it is in search of kind of a comfort, in search of kind of a happiness. But if happiness is available within, if happiness is available internally, then it doesn't want to go outside. So similarly here, when the body becomes comfortable, when the body becomes pleasurable, then, and the mind also feeling tranquil, then basically the mind doesn't want to wander, it simply remains. Doesn't want to think about the past, doesn't want to think about the future, because the present is quite pleasant, we can see. When the present moment become more and more pleasant, abiding, then the mind doesn't want to wander. It will simply remain in the present moment. So therefore this happiness, joy, or the comfort, what we call as the sukha, is capable of abandoning what we call the uddaccha kukkuccha, that is the restlessness and worry. So there can't be restlessness and worry because mind is quite comfortable here, being in the present moment. Present moment doesn't give you any kind of worry, because they are simply the pleasant phenomena going on. Body also feels comfortable, mind also feels tranquil, things are happening smoothly. And then mind is also concentrated, well focused onto a particular object. So if it is the primary object, now the primary object is the one once focused. And as a result of that, kamachanda, what we call as a sensual desire, doesn't find any kind of a place. So when sensual desire is available, it keeps jumping from one object to the other object. But now there is no such thing, because mind is well concentrated, well collected. So as a result of that, mind remains quiet, mind remains calm, mind remains steady, and there is no any kind of wandering. And so this ekagata, so this concentration, is opposite to the sensual desire. Now sensual desire, kamachanda, is also abandoned. So likewise we can say these five jhanic factors, vitakka, vichara, piti, sukha, ekagata, applied mind, sustained mind, rapture, happiness, and concentration, are quite opposite to five hindrances. And then one can say, okay, one is in the first jhana. Now there are maybe various levels of first jhana one can go through. So, and again one can even say, even when one is doing some kind of a vipassana practice, that also quite similar to first jhana, because various phenomena are arising. Again and again one's mind is applied to that and continuously investigated. And as a result of that, when things are happening smoothly, one feels confident, happy, joyful, and there is no regret because the present moment is quite pleasant and one is continuing in one's practice, investigation, and there is no doubt. And therefore, even when one is doing some sort of, say, Dhatu Manasikara, Elements Meditation, Vedananupassana, the sort of recognizing various different kinds of feelings, and even when one is recognizing various thoughts, properly, if one is doing that, one can say, okay, he is in the first jhana. Now, so if one is continuing this, Buddha mentioned, for his own delight, relief and comfort. So there's a kind of a relief in the mind because the hindrances are abandoned and kind of happiness is there. And since all nivaranas, hindrances are abandoned, mind is quite peaceful. So it's very much like a very peaceful abiding in one's mind. Then number two, the second jhana. So in the second jhana, one has abandoned vitakka and vichara. One's attention is firmly established on the object. So there is no wavering, there is no any kind of a slight movement, but now the mind is very well fixed upon the whatever the object of attention. And Buddha mentioned so too, with the subsiding of thought and examination, a noble disciple enters and dwells in the second jhana, which has internal placidity and unification of mind and consists of rapture and pleasure born of concentration. So the difference between the first and the second, in the first jhana there is a little movement in the mind because again and again mind has to be applied to the incoming object, approaching object. And again the mind has to examine this new object. But in the second, so very much like, so those phenomena are somewhat calmed down and one's concentration remains quite firm, steady. So there is no movement in the mind. Mind has very much like become quite still, steady. So that is the feature of the second jhana. So that movement, little frustration in the mind has abandoned. Now mind further become quite concentrated, strongly concentrated. So that is called the second jhana. So the three jhana factors are available: rapture, happiness and the concentration. Then number three. So actually Buddha mentioned these are quite similar to various different kinds of food. The first one is quite similar to grass, firewood and all those kind of requisites necessary to prepare food. And then number two is related to rice and barley, which are the different grains available in the fortress. Number three, various kinds of food stuff. Now that is the third jhana. There's sort of metaphorically mentioned as similar to the food stuff. Sesame, green gram, beans, etc., etc., different kinds of food stuff available in the kingdom so that the residents can properly maintain themselves. Similarly, Buddha mentioned, in third jhana, one has abandoned the gross rapture. Now what is available is a very kind of pleasant abiding, kind of a peaceful abiding, happy abiding is there. So jhana factors in available there are this pleasant happiness and then the concentration. So those are the two jhana factors available in the third jhana, and that is where Buddha mentioned dwells equanimous and mindful and clearly comprehending. He experiences pleasure with the body. He enters and dwells in the third jhana, of which the noble ones declare he is equanimous, mindful, one who dwells happily. These are the descriptions given for the third jhana. So one is staying there and one enters there, dwells there. So his abiding is quite pleasant, and that is the third jhana. So this is also available in the Vipassana side if we sort of consider. So when different phenomena have fairly subsided, different phenomena have become somewhat detached, one is now maintaining kind of a relaxed awareness. So one doesn't need to purposely, deliberately apply one's mind onto various phenomena. Now various phenomena have become somewhat faded away and they have gone to some far to some extent. And one simply dwells in the middle without grasping anything, but they are still available in the vicinity, but not interested. One can live peacefully. So this is very much like the third jhana in vipassana, where kind of pleasant abiding is there. There is no any friction coming from various different phenomena, and mind is well concentrated. Actually, here the concentration doesn't mean that one's mind is focused onto a particular phenomena. Rather, one's mind is very clean, very clear. There is no any cluttering in the mind. Mind has become quite transparent-like. So that is the third jhana, we can say, available in the vipassana. Now the fourth jhana. So Buddha mentioned various different kinds of besajja. That is ghee, butter, oil, honey, molasses, salt, etc. are also available in the kingdom. Similarly, Buddha mentioned the fourth jhana, abandoning of pleasure and pain, and with the previous passing away of joy and dejection, a noble disciple enters and dwells in the fourth jhana, neither painful nor pleasant, which has purification of mindfulness by equanimity. So now the equanimity is quite strong, and the mindfulness is therefore fairly purified, and the equanimity is very much the most prominent factor, and this is called the fourth jhana. So in the samatha side, tranquility side, so there we can say one's mind is well concentrated, again mindfulness is there, clarity of mind is there, one's mind is well absorbed to the object. But on the other hand, in the vipassana side, one has completely abandoned all the phenomena, no attachment, no grasping, one's mind is quite clear, quite spacious, and quite equanimous. This we can say as the fourth jhana in vipassana. So if one is capable of attaining such jhana, it is very much like one's having a kind of a pleasant abiding. Time to time one is capable of attaining their experience in that, and it is very much like taking nutriments to one's own mind, because sometimes when one's dealing with various day-to-day activities, one's mind becomes quite disturbed, cluttered. And if one is entering this jhana, either first, in the first, second, third, fourth, either using samatha or vipassana, so that refreshes the mind. Very much like mind become quite charged or repaired, or again taken to the placidity, taken to the kind of clarity, relaxed peacefulness, particularly available in the fourth jhana, where very relaxed peacefulness is available. Fair equanimity is available. So if one is capable of being there at least sometime during one's day, so that basically calms down the mind. All different kinds of fetters, disturbances, hindrances aroused during day's activity are all abandoned. Now again mind becomes very clean, very clear, lucid kind of clarity is available. So these are the four jhanas that constitute the higher mind and are pleasant dwellings in this very life, which he gains at will without trouble or difficulty. So Buddha mentioned Nikamalabhi hoti, Akichalabhi, Akasiralabhi. So these terms represent that quickly one can attain that. So he doesn't want much of a struggle to attain them. So very things are quite easily approachable. He can attain whatever the jhana very quickly without much trouble. When bhikkhus, a noble disciple possesses these seven good qualities, And when he gains at will, without trouble or difficulty, these four jhanas that constitute the higher mind and are pleasant dwellings in this very life. He is then called a noble disciple who cannot be assailed by Mara, who cannot be assailed by the evil one. So Buddha mentioned, Yathoko bhikkhave arya savako imehi sattahi saddhammehi samannagato hoti. Imesancha chatunnan jhananam abhischetasikhanam ditadamma sukha viharanam nikamalabhi hoti akichchalabhi akasiralabhi ayam ucchati bhikkhave arya savako akaraniyo marasa akaraniyo papimatoti. So now if he has all these seven qualities plus these four jhanas, then he is beyond Mara's pasture. Mara can't attack him because he is very well equipped. He is fairly developed. There are seven qualities. So starting with faith on the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. So he has strong faith and he has moral shame, moral dread. And then he is quite equipped with the knowledge about the Buddha's teaching. And then he has a very good effort. And then he has mindfulness and he has wisdom. So these are the essential qualities one has to have. And then on the other hand, one can attain some kind of a vipassana or samatha concentration. And that very much like partaking food. Partaking one's meals. So suppose that daily that he has to be involved with various activities, but he has some time to relax, to attain, to sort of rest, to maintain his mind in complete clarity, maintain one's mind in complete lucidity. So that is very much like partaking food. So basically that helps to again establish himself clarity of mind, unattached nature of the mind, particularly if we consider the vipassana side. Again and again during a day, during a time in the day, if one is capable of attaining very relaxed awareness with no attachment, with no desires, with no any grasping, so complete equanimous, so that is very much a relaxed state for the mind and completely refreshes the mind. All the tensions, stresses are abandoned. All the defilements are abandoned. Again, one has fully established oneself in very pleasant, clear, pure kind of awareness. So these are the things that Buddha mentioned that one has to have. Then it is very much like a well-protected fortress. One's mind is very much like a well-protected fortress. So with that, I like to conclude today's sutta teaching session. Now I like to open the session for questions. Do you have any question?
We can wait.
Yeah, so he likes to wait sometime till he digests the thing.
Sure. If we have any new participants joining us, you can participate in the Q&A by raising your hand or sending your questions via chat. Is there a way, let's say, using vipassana to, enter into so-called jhana qualities? How can one use what method to actually assess which jhana one is in?
Yeah, so that is very good. Now, say, if we take one example, say we are practicing Vedanupassana. So various feelings are there now. The pleasurable feelings are there, equanimous feelings are there, painful feelings are there. Now, suppose that you have very good patience developed. Again, you have fair amount of mindfulness developed. And again, you have very good focus attention developed. Now you are keeping your attention on incoming feelings. A new pleasurable feeling arises, you are quickly focusing your attention there and you start applying your mind to that. Suppose there is a painful feeling arises, quickly you can apply your mind to that. When an equanimous feeling arises, quickly you can apply your mind to that. So the applied thought is therefore available. The vitakka is available. Now, once you apply your mind, you start investigating that what type of the pleasurable, painful, equanimous feeling. So you quickly know, okay, this is a pleasurable feeling, this is a painful feeling, this is a equanimous feeling. So likewise, so the investigation is also available. So that is the vichara. So when one becomes capable of doing this, now previously there may be distractions, there may be different difficulties in the practice, but later one become quite confident in one's practice and comfortably one can continue this whole process, and it is not very much like deliberate practice now. It is not that you need to sort of forcefully do it, rather mind become capable of doing it by its own. So again and again different types of feelings are arising, again and again mind automatically applies one's mind to there and continue the practice. So that is where the comfort arises. That is where you feel at ease. So that is where a little bit of pressure, a little bit of happiness, a joy can arise. So that is also available. So the joy is also available. And sukha, you feel confident, you feel comfortable, you feeling at ease, the body also not giving much trouble because things are happening smoothly, so the comfort, happiness is also available. And again to various different phenomena, mind get quickly concentrated. So the instantaneous concentration is available, one-pointedness is available. So the ekagata is also available. So this stage, we can therefore say, is quite similar to first jhana. Because all the five jhana factors are available. Now, when one continues this for a while, so these different kinds of pressure, painful, equanimous feelings become very much like same. Now one can't distinguish whether it is the pressure, pleasurable, painful, equanimous, but just a kind of a sensation is there, kind of a minor feeling is there. You can't distinguish what it is, and simply you need to maintain your attention at that place, because the same place things are happening, and you don't need to change your place of attention. And you are simply keeping your attention on a particular place, quite confirmed, quite still, and some kind of a feeling is happening and you are simply being aware of that. So here actually the vitakka doesn't need to do kind of a rigorous kind of applying mind. Rigorous kind of investigation is not necessary. So one is kind of a smoothly maintaining one's attention, that's all. Kind of a refinement has happened. So this we can say quite similar to second jhana, where the applied mind and the sustained investigation has abandoned. It's a simple matter of maintaining one's attention at a particular place. Some kind of a phenomena is arising and passing away, and one is simply aware of that. In the third stage, so the phenomena has completely, very much like we can say disappeared, or we can say somewhat went far away. So there's a kind of a distance from yourself and the phenomena. So different phenomena are available, but there's a distance. So mind is not even interested of even investigating that. So they are very much like little far away. But they are still available, but you being quite detached from that, dispassionate from that. So there we can say there is no any friction coming from the various phenomena, and one is simply maintaining one's attention quite smooth, quite steady, and simple awareness is there. So, I mean, since there is no friction coming from different phenomena because of their vulnerable behavior, so one is now quite peaceful internally. So these phenomena are the ones vulnerable. They are the ones arising and passing away. But now you are a little apart from them. You are little sort of away from them. So this we can say somewhat similar to third jhana, where kind of a pleasant abiding is available and equanimity is to some extent available. And the fourth jhana is where all the phenomena are completely abandoned, completely relinquished. One's mind is fully attained kind of equanimity. So nothing is there. So no grasping at all. No attachment at all. And even no object at all. So mind become completely relaxed, completely equanimous, completely peaceful. So this is very similar to the fourth jhana, where complete equanimity is available. So therefore it is quite possible to explain jhana in terms of vipassana, and therefore sometimes certain scholars argue, so this is what exactly Buddha mentioned. It is not kind of a strong absorption to a particular object firmly that Buddha suggested, rather seeing how they are quickly arising and passing away, investigating them. As a result of that practice, now mind become dispassionate and ultimately relinquish everything. So this is the kind of say progressive stages one may experience during vipassana, and we can say this first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, and ultimately the fourth jhana. And there are various vipassana terms also available, like the fourth one we can call as maybe signless concentration or emptiness, we can call them, but still quite similar to fourth jhana. And even actually fourth jhana itself has some other flavors, like it becomes completely boundless, spacious. So that is where one moves towards the arupa jhana, and to some extent that quality is also come into the picture as one continues in vipassana.
Thank you, Bhante. So this is interesting. So I guess as you move deeper into the vipassana jhanas, there is you're noticing less of the phenomena. So I guess in that case, how can we still gain the knowledge of, let's say, dukkha or non-self or impermanence?
Yeah, I mean, that is possible at the early stages, say in the first jhana, second jhana, and to some extent the third jhana, where you experience this impermanence, particularly in the first and second, one experience because one investigates. So investigation is available, particularly in the first jhana. So as one investigates, what one understands is the impermanence. What one understands is the vulnerability, the inconstant nature of all these different phenomena. And it is beyond your control. So this understanding is causing slowly to abandon them, to develop some kind of a dispassion towards them. So that is the kind of a maturity happening within one's mind. So when one is in the fourth jhana, actually one is not experiencing any kind of impermanence or vulnerability, oppression of rising and passing away, because everything, those conditioned phenomena are abandoned. One's mind is completely peaceful now, and being in the equanimity, being in the unattached, non-grasping state. And so at the non-grasping state, it's a simple, peaceful dwelling.
Okay, thank you, Bhante.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to invite Sohani for the next question.
Thank you, Jennifer. Avasarai, Bhante.
Yeah.
My question is actually on equanimity. in that state where you say it's simply dwelling, in a state of non-grasping, but there too there is a sense of kind of a calm and happiness, isn't there?
Mm-hmm.
So what exactly is equanimity? Is it something that is between dukkha and the pain and pleasure, or how do we recognize equanimity?
Mm-hmm. So more and more you become neutral. So you are not reacting to any phenomena. Now previously there is a kind of impulsive reaction happen in one's mind. Now you become more equanimous. They may be available. You may see things, you may hear things, but you are not reacting to them. So this is the type of equanimity we are calling here. It's not only the equanimous feeling, but you are quite equanimous towards what is going on as with different phenomena. So different phenomena are available, but you are not getting involved with them. You are not disturbing them. You are not interfering them. So you maintain the equanimity in your side. So that may, as you said, have a kind of a pleasant abiding. It is not very dry kind of an equanimity, but you feel quite pleasant, very being at ease. There is no friction, no stress.
Okay, clear. Thank you very much, Bhante.
Yeah,
Well, I had a comment, Bhante, just to add. I think that Westerners particularly tend to be sort of problem-solving and intellectual, and they see like all these concepts, equanimity and just the various stages of jhanas, and the fact that there are different stages and that they have different qualities. And this is related to when I read Dhamma books, books on meditation, I've noticed that it seems to be like it explains the processes of what happens when we meditate, and it's like coming at it from, okay, I've done that, now I'm going to explain to you what it's like and how you might try to attain that, how to how you might incline your mind towards these qualities.
Mm-hmm.
So it sort of encourages you and gives you some ways to prepare your mind, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting that I've always heard that these attainments or these qualities just arise without, you know, without our intellectual involvement.
Mm.
So it's just interesting to me, because I've started to experience many of these different qualities in my meditation, and actually your instruction to me was to basically let go and just let the process happen. And the process is very simple. It's just being aware, as you said, of being aware of whatever there is present. Whether if you're still just focusing on the breath, just be aware of the breath. Can you be aware of the breath from the beginning to the end, and the gap in between, and then continuing? Eventually, then something else will happen. Maybe one of these states will arise, equanimousness or tranquility of body and mind. And then at that point, what I understand is to just be aware of the quality, this new really breakthrough sort of experience of the body and mind that's manifesting, be aware of that. And it's not so important to focus on the breath at that point.
Mm.
But to more just be aware of now what's arising, because that's the major experience that's happening now. And so that experience of tranquility of body and mind arising, we don't get to choose it. It just comes on its own.
Yeah,
so
yeah, you can't condition your mind with some qualities. Rather, as your mind is blossoming, very much like a flower is blossoming, naturally.
Yeah.
When sunlight is available, when breeze is available, when the nutrients is taken, the slowly the flower is blossoming, simply like that. So the mind, as you correctly explained, so when we are fairly at paying attention to the present moment, what is going on in the present moment, and you don't worry about attaining anything or this jhana or that jhana. Rather, you are fully aware of what is happening right now, and you are doing the investigation, and as a result of that, kind of knowledge arising, wisdom arising. So that takes care of developing another quality, that is the dispassion and kind of detachment.
Mm-hmm.
So that helps you to, I mean, the mind is now capable of relinquishing. So when enough knowledge is available, enough insights are available, when enough dispassion is available, the relinquishment may happen naturally, and it is not that we willfully do any kind of relinquishment. The letting go process become quite natural.
Yes.
And then it's a matter of simply dwelling in that relinquished nature or the kind of released nature.
Yes.
So as you mentioned, so it is very much like a kind of a receptive awareness. So you are not anticipating anything. Rather, you are quite ready to accept what is happening right now. And you are sort of operating on that in the present moment level, and the things may naturally evolve, isn't it?
Yes, but
yeah.
And that's exactly, you're hinting at what I got from that is just that at that point when there's the point where you can just relinquish and be receptive, at that point the mind also has the continuing tendency to question and try to grasp hold and like decide what's happening now,
mm-hmm.
or something,
mm-hmm.
but that's the time to just
abandon,
completely let go, and
exactly. So I have to
open up to the experience,
exactly.
Or something.
Open up to the experience, and I should not get involved.
Yes, the big I
should not get involved. The capital I should not get involved in the
yes.
process. And I simply have to take the back seat and allow the process to naturally happen.
It's a beautiful thing because I think Westerners especially have a lot of doubts
mm.
and attachment as well because of our materialistic background.
Mm.
And but it's a wonderful thing to let go of all that. It's
mm.
like a burden just released.
Exactly.
Wow, that's not something hard. Just
exactly.
let go and
exactly.
experience.
Exactly.
Thank
yeah,
you,
Bhante. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, back to you, Jennifer.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to invite Mahisha for the next question.
Thank you, Jennifer. Bhante, my question is about Vojana. So having said that, according to the sutta we discussed today, so these Vojanas considered in the, as a similar to grains and all those foodstuff that we store in a kingdom for, you know, people to use when they need, like in the different seasons, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
So, actually, this is my second question. First question is different, I'll ask it later.
Mm-hmm.
So, my question is actually now, if you consider it as such, so making sure that we attain jhana is something like we trying to preserve or save some in case when we need them in a case of a difficulty or
mm.
something like that. Is that what it means in the sutta?
I feel actually very much like partaking food is a kind of a necessity, time to time required to nourish your body. So similarly, say if mind is going through some turbulence and if mind is going through some ups and downs, and due to various days activities, so mind become little frustrated, mind become little agitated, sort of feel burdened. So those things can accumulate because of the day's activities. Now, very much like you are partaking food, now when you attain a jhana, then it's all those disturbances, all those different, say, hindrances, turbulence, everything is now abandoned. Again, mind become quite refreshed. Again, mind become quite peaceful. So I think this is where I found it is quite metaphorically equal to partaking food, because partaking food is where your body become refreshed, your body become again developed or charged or improved your vitality, refreshed. All these things are there, energetic, and all these, they are similar to the body. Now your mind also can, after going through a proper jhana, mind also become refreshed, mind also become quite charged or energetic, relaxed, peaceful. So that is there. Now all the previous agitation, frustrations, everything is now abandoned.
The way that I have taken, I understand what you explained now.
Mm-hmm.
So if we practice daily jhana, so in case of difficult situation in life, then we can use it like to feed the mind, to stay calm, something like that. That's what I understood. Is that right?
Yeah, so, Yes. Because, thing is, now, on the other hand, we should be capable of handling day's activities or say ups and downs of life also equanimously, and at that very moment, if we are capable of handling them properly with using proper vipassana, then you may not get much disturbed. So your mind is capable of handling them properly, enough resilience is available in the mind. So as a result of that, the impact of those various incidents become less and less. So mind is capable of retaining the clarity. Mind is capable of retaining the equanimity or the peacefulness in the mind, even though various ups and downs are happening. But sometimes still there may be little disturbances. Sometimes there could be a certain agitation. So likewise, if so, then you can attain jhana and again, relax, calm down, and all these things are possible.
Yeah, but at the time of difficulty, if we try to practice vipassana, naturally you drag towards the jhanas, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what I also think, because these jhanas are not, we need to attribute only to the samatha side. So as many scholars are now mentioning, so what Buddha mentioned is more into vipassana, where investigation, applied mind, you are going through this investigation process to various phenomena. That is the one contributing towards the bodhjanga, the enlightenment factors. And so that we can say, okay, this is the first jhana. Then after some time, mind becomes firm about what's going on and no quite a big distinction about different phenomena. But something is only to a very refined level going on, simply a matter of keeping one's attention there and observing that. So this is quite similar to second jhana. So likewise, kind of a progressive stages are available in the vipassana, and that we can say are the jhanas that one can continue in vipassana practice, and that is also quite refreshing. Again and again, mind become improved or developed in the equanimity, developed in the wisdom, and the peacefulness is ultimately available.
Yes, thank you, Bhante. Yeah. The first question actually I wanted to ask was, now with the four jhanas, now you explained it very well today as well, and in previous couple of sessions also I heard you explaining it. But when I was listening to you, I always, my mind telling to me, don't worry, whether it's was first, second, third, or fourth, you just keep doing.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to worry whether you are in the first level, second level, fourth level, whatever.
Exactly.
It doesn't matter.
Exactly.
Just do it.
Exactly.
Just do it and just move on with what you're doing. So is that right? The way that I'm doing, I was thinking.
Exactly. Not at all necessary. Yeah, we don't need to label. If you need to label, then that's a kind of a situation where come out of the jhana. We then become.
Yeah, I realize that.
Exactly.
I experience that, yeah.
Yeah, then kind of eye making, mind making also can happen. So it's a kind of a disturbance to the process. It's allowing, as we discussed just now. So we simply have to allow the flower to blossom naturally.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't need to sort of make a comment,
right.
Make a kind of a comment on that, or we don't need to forcefully do anything. Rather, naturally, we are fully satisfied, fully aware what is going on, and we simply allow the process to naturally unfold.
Thank you, Bhante. I want to just clarify that
yeah.
What I'm doing is right. So
correct.
Thank you so much.
Okay,
Bhante.
Okay, welcome.
Bhante, I have a follow up question. So,
mm-hmm.
For the Vipassana jhanas, are we able to actually jump to a specific jhana? Kind of like with samadhi jhana, if we, you know, remove some of the jhana factors, then we can go from, let's say, the first jhana and jump to the third jhana. Is that possible for Vipassana jhana, or does it just need to naturally progress?
I think at the early stages we can't jump. We better go through systematically. But when one is more and more confident, particularly in the fourth jhana. Now, say for example, one is becoming more and more capable of maintaining equanimity. More and more capable of establishing oneself on the sort of released mind, relaxed mind, non-grasping mind, then the first, second, even third may not necessary. Simply one can abide in the fourth. So that is what Buddha mentioned in the Salayatana Vibhanga Sutta, where the progressive stages ultimately have some similarity towards the fourth jhana. And the different tastes of fourth jhana he mentioned coupled with the arupa jhana. So where all different distinctions are abandoned, now one's mind become quite oneness kind of thing. It's quite at the same flavor type of thing. So in terms of the feelings, Buddha explained upekkha ekatta ekattasita. So kind of an equanimity is there. It is very much unity of equanimity. There is no distinctions. So mind doesn't sort of do any kind of different investigations. Rather, mind quite become equanimous. That's it. That's all. Kind of a relaxed equanimity is there. So I therefore feel, so at the early stages, yes, definitely we have to go through everything one after the other. So that is much better. Kind of a progressive stages are happening. But later, more and more mind is inclined towards the fourth, fairly established on the fourth, and now one becomes confident being in the fourth. And then no need to go through the previous one, one can simply plunge into the fourth. And maybe, I mean, the previous ones also may be little possible. Now say for example, if one is in the third also where mind is quite, detached, but at the vicinity still some phenomena are available, but mind is somewhat detached, relaxed, no friction. So if one is continue that stage, so that becomes one's posture, that becomes one's capable in the dwelling. So probably one can rather go into first and second, one can simply jump into that as well. Later one can get into the fourth, and then one can abandon the third also and can simply jump or plunge into fourth.
Okay, thank you, Bhante.
Yep.
So,
yeah.
What's the name of the Nikaya that this comes from?
This sutta is in the Anguttara Nikaya. Anguttara Nikaya, seventh factor.
Okay, thank you, Bhante.
Yeah.
And also, after the four jhanas, there are something like, I don't know, three or four more states that continue, like emptiness or non.
Yeah, so in the fourth jhana, different flavors are there. So they are attributed as the arupa jhana. So akasananchayatana, vinyananchayatana, akinchanyayatana, and nevasanya, nasanyayatana. Akasananchayatana is the kind of the complete boundless awareness of the space. Then the Vijnananchayatana is complete boundless awareness of the consciousness. Then the Akinchanyayatana is complete boundless awareness of nothingness. And neva sanya na sanya etana is complete boundless awareness of neither perception nor non-perception. So, I mean, how we can exactly map this with the vipassana is something that we need to carefully do. In the spaciousness, of course, we can say, okay, when mind become, at the first instance, you can't say that immediately mind become boundless. So, I mean, mind has now abandoned everything, relinquished everything, and simply dwelling in that, but still with a kind of a little boundary. Still your mind has not fully expanded. But later, as one is continued, so this region becomes more and more boundless. So your awareness, your clarity of the mind, and the freedom of the mind become more and more expanded. So therefore we can say, okay, now you are getting to the levels of the akasa nanchayatana, where the complete, full, spacious, boundless awareness is available. So the mind become fully spacious. You can't say this is the boundary of the mind, and is very much a pervaded kind of awareness. And then the second one, say vijnananchayatana, the consciousness, you are fully aware. I mean, it is not only the spaciousness, so you can sort of be aware. Now the awareness is available everywhere. Previously, very much like the spacious, your mind become quite spacious. All the different phenomena troubling you, various signs disturbing you, are all sort of being abandoned. You have erased them, very much like. So the space is available. But in that space, awareness is also available. Right? So it is not that you are unaware of that space, but you are aware of that space. So the awareness is also available, and it is also boundless. So your awareness is all around the universe, you can say. Mm-hmm. Something like that. Mm-hmm. And in the third, nothingness, and there is no any symptom of I-ness, myself, a person. So there is nothing. Kind of an emptiness is there. So there is no any sign of a person. So that I-making, mind-making has fully abandoned. So, I mean, simple dwelling is there. So in that nothingness, I mean, I couldn't find exact interpretation. Maybe we need to explore something more. Whether to this level it is explained, we need to recognize. But one can say, okay, this is how one is further and further continuing. But I am little doubtful about the fourth one, neither perception nor non-perception. So maybe we can call them in terms of the perception. Now the perception, all different, the mundane kind of perceptions are abandoned. Now that is explained in the Kalaha Vivada Sutta, in terms of Arahant's mind. In terms of Arahant's mind, Buddha gave a very interesting explanation with respect to perceptions. Na sanya sanyi, na visanya sanyi, no pi asanyi, na vibhuta sanyi, evan sametasa vibhuti rupang, sanya nidanahi pa pancha sankha. So this is the very beautiful verse available in the Kalaha Vivada Sutta of Sutta Nipata. So Buddha gave a kind of very interesting explanation about Arahant's mind with respect to perception. So where the typical mundane kinds of perceptions are not there. And again, that is na sanya sanyi, na visanya sanyi. He is not kind of a deformed kind of perception either. And he is also not unconscious. He is fully conscious. He is fully aware. Na visanya sanyi, no pi asanyi. And he is not suppress all the other things by using a strong awareness, strong concentration. He is in a relaxed awareness. So in the asanya satta, the idea is he has developed, using the samatha practice, very strong concentration, and using that strong concentration, he He's suppressing all the different kinds of perceptions happening in the mind. But here, as a result of the proper understanding of the nature of different phenomena, now mind doesn't want to grasp anything. It's a kind of a natural awareness. So, therefore, it is not forceful suppression of the perceptions, but it's a kind of a very natural abandoning of perceptions. Navisanya sanyi, nopiya sanyi, navibhuta sanyi. And he hasn't completely destroyed the perception either. If necessary, he can simply, quickly switch back to the natural, typical, mundane kind of perception at any time either. You can see, I mean, how beautifully Buddha has explained that state. So I think this can be somewhat equal to, in the Vipassana terms, we can say neither perception nor no non-perception. So this is my explanation. So, I mean, we don't need to really say, okay, we need to find out a ruler and sort of have a kind of a margin and all these things, something. But these are the kind of progressive stages we can understand in the Vipassana practice, how one is slowly developing, going through all these different further refinements in one's understanding.
It's good to know that there's at least there is a continuing infinite practice. It doesn't just end with the fourth jhana, and it's just continuing to become refined.
Refined. More and more, in other terms, what we can say is that your awareness become more and more expanded. The clarity of mind become more and more expanded. And the friction is no more. No tension, no stress. And say, mind making, all these personality views and all these things are now abandoned. So likewise, so your mind become more and more purified. So that is being represented as we are more progressing towards the jhana in terms of vipassana.
Thank you, Bhante.
Yeah. Okay, I think there are no questions further. So then we can wind up the session today. So we have spent, I think, more than 1 hour today also discussing a sutta teaching. Actually, this ends the Nagarupama Sutta. And whatever the merits that we have accumulated through this discussion, we'll share with all the past relatives, all the celestial beings, and whoever in need of merits. And we wish these merits help us also to attain path, fruition, nibbana. While keeping these good wishes in our mind, let's recite the traditional verses. Ettavata ca amhehi sambatang punya sampadang sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampatti siddhya. Ettavata ca amhehi sambatang punya sampadang sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampatti siddhya. Ettavata ca amhehi sambatang punya sampadang sabbe satta anumodantu sabba sampatti siddhya. Akasattha ca bummatta deva naga mahiddhika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakkantu sasanang. Akasattha ca bummatta deva naga mahiddhika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakkantu desanang. Akasattha ca bummatta deva naga mahiddhika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakkantu mamparam. Idang vo nyatinang hotu sukita huntu nyatayo. Idang vo nyatinang hotu sukita huntu nyatayo. Idang vo nyatinang hotu sukita huntu nyatayo. Imina punya kammena satang samagamo hotu yava nibbana pattiya. Imina punya kammena mame bala samagamo satang samagamo hotu yava nibbana pattiya. Imina punya kammena mame bala samagamo satang samagamo hotu yava nibbana pattiya. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.